along the way as the rubble would drive. The methane, they noticed, it was constant all year long, well, Martian year long. One Martian year is roughly a little longer than two of our years. But during the summer, they would get higher readings of methane, and then it would drop off again. And because of the longevity of Curiosity, now it has gone through six of our years, three Mars years, they're able to get repeating results. So every summer, or Martian summer, the methane goes up. Now, you know, a lot of people will think, well, if the methane's going up in the summer, it's getting warmer, bacteria is more active in under the ground and creating more methane. But the scientist that was on talking about that said that's not necessarily the case. The methane is always the same. The same is being produced, and whatever it's being produced by, they still don't know for sure, but it's being produced globally. But during the summer, it starts to come out more. The reason for that is the ground expands a little bit more, and little cracks and crevices open up. And the methane is able to come out easier, so that's why they're getting higher readings in the summertime. So the way he used the word, he said it's constant, year-round, but in the summertime, because of the crevices, that's what's modulating. He called it modulating the methane signal. So I thought that was interesting. This is WS, come on. So that's the story on that, and let's see. One other topic I wanted to just briefly go over is SpaceX. They were talking about launching thousands of satellites. Now it turns out SpaceX wants to launch a total of 11,000 satellites, 4,000 at a higher elevation, like 700 miles up, and then another 7,000 satellites at maybe 200 or 300 miles up, and these satellites are going to be for internet connections. He's calling it the Starlink service. So his idea is eventually do away with Cablevision and Viacom, and you're going to be able to transmit with an antenna on your roof right up to orbiting satellites to have your internet connection. So, what I read earlier, that big satellites, like the ones that go to geosynchronous orbit, might be declining by 40%. The smaller satellites in lower Earth orbit, according to this, would be really increasing dramatically. So somebody's going to have to put all these things up there. They probably could put up 100 at a time. That's the way it's actually getting, there was one launch with 104 satellites at one time in India. India did that, using one of their rockets. So that's pretty much it. There's a couple other stories we cover, but just want to mention the New Horizon. That's the one that went to Pluto a couple years back in 2015. Their goal is to go to a new rock out in the Kuiper Belt object. And they expect to fly right past that thing, very close to it, the pictures and everything. On New Year's Day, right after New Year's Eve, this thing's going to fly through this year, 2019, officially. First day of 2019. So that should be interesting. Two important dates to look forward to with robotic equipment, and that would be New Horizons, and the other one I mentioned, InSight, which will be landing on Mars this year, the day after Thanksgiving. Any questions or comments for the SpaceNet report? This is WS2N.
A quick question, if I could.
Okay, go ahead and your call.
Hey, KD2PPF. I'm just wondering, when they do launch satellites, there must be some projection of the trajectory of the satellites so that they don't crash into other satellites. That must be something pretty major, right?
Out there, and there's all kinds of stuff that goes on with government. they only allow certain windows of opportunity for the L-1011 to launch Pegasus. So naturally, they have missed their window, so it might take a couple of months to reschedule and fly it. But I'm looking forward to it because it's going to launch ICON, which is the Ionosphere Connection Explorer, into equatorial orbit, but it will be studying the ionosphere, which is a big thing for hams. It's going to be looking at everything that the ionosphere does, you know, anywhere from that, 30 miles to up to, you know, maybe 400 miles or something, or even higher. And it's going to look at the how it's affected, which way the ions flow, and the clouds, you know, ion clouds that are created, and this way they're able to eventually, in the future, predict better, you know, when there's going to be better or worse communications for not only us, you know, on Earth, but for satellites in orbit. Sometimes it's affected by the ionosphere. Sometimes to the point where it's all shut down, it won't even work. So, Orbital ATK got to build this thing. It was supposed to launch over a year ago, but quite a few delays, and now it looks like it's going to have another delay. And it's got all kinds of equipment on board, and unfortunately, we're not going to see that go for a while. And it was going to work in conjunction with one that was launched back in January. We talked about it on one of the nets in January. It was called the Gold Satellite. Now, the Gold Satellite was attached to a commercial satellite, first time ever for something like that. And Gold was launched. Let me drop it. Attaches to the commercial satellite and into geosynchronous orbit. Now it's going to look down at the whole ring of the Earth, the ionosphere of the Earth, and ICON was going to be up close, you know, orbiting every 90 minutes. But the two of them were going to work in conjunction to try to really work and to find out what the ionosphere is really all about. GOLD was they call it the Global Scale Observation of the Lemons and Disc, you know, so some complicated long name. Basically, it was just going to sit out there, and every half hour it was going to take a picture of the ionosphere, which it's been doing, you know, since January, permanently attached to a commercial satellite, getting the power from the commercial satellites, solar panels. So NASA didn't have to send up an independent satellite, just went for a ride on this other one. So SES-14, that was the name of the commercial satellite. If you want to Google that, SES-14. It was a communication satellite. And GOLD went along for the ride. So that's pretty much it. Any questions or comments for the net? This is WS2N. Okay, I really don't have anything else here, but let me see if Dick is still out there listening to the end of the net. Got a little over half hour left. K2RIW, WS2N.
Do you have other subjects that can take up some time? Paul, go ahead.
That's pretty much it. Unless you had questions, you talk about this one proposal. I'm happy the name of it, but I forgot what it stands for. And it's the Alluvior, L-U-V-O-I-R telescope that they wanted to launch. Just looked at it the other day, but didn't get much information. But scale of this thing, it makes James Webb look tiny, and they're looking at probably 4,000. Well, I was going to say, I forgot the number. I forget, well, whatever, but the diameter of this thing is going to be 15 meters in diameter. So, what do they call it? I wrote it down here somewhere on an index card. Large ultraviolet optical survey, I guess it's called. But they plan on building this thing for over $4 billion. And, you know, a 15-meter diameter mirror compared to James Webb, which is 6.5 meter across, so over twice that diameter. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know how they're going to get this thing approved. But actually, they said it is approved again. You know, it's a matter of building this thing. Back to you, Dick.
Is that thing also going to go to Lagrange Point number two?
This thing is going to be, no, I'm not sure. I didn't read enough about it. But there's a couple of other telescopes that are going to be built, too. There's going to be one that's going to eventually replace the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which has been functioning since, I guess, 1990. And I know they want to build one of those called LINX, LYNX, an X-ray observatory similar to Chandler. They want to put that thing up. There's a lot of stuff on the drawing board there. But I'll be happy to see James Webb get up there. But there's stuff behind it. It never ends.
You think they've hit the last delay on James Webb? And let's see, it was supposed to be launched by now already. What's the latest predicted launch date on James Webb? Is it almost 2020?
Yes, you're right. You're right. Yeah, it was supposed to go up, this October or so. The latest was, 2018, and that was pushed to 2019, and now 2020. I did hear they have found a lot of the ways to fix some of the problems that they've had. So hopefully they'll work that out. But, I remember it was supposed to go up this year. They were having launch conflicts with Colombo BEPI. Colombo BEPI is a combined launch of two spacecraft that are going to investigate Mercury. And it's by the European Space Agency. So it's being launched by the Ariane rocket from French Guiana, South America. And there was discussions, when are we going to, we're supposed to launch the James Webb at that time. And European Space Agency is like, well, we have a certain time window. We have to launch because we're going to do all these gravitational assists. Let me drop it. With the Earth, two times past Venus, and I think it's four times past Venus to slow it to get into it. It's orbit around Mercury, a couple times past Mercury. So we have a certain time we have to launch, and NASA's getting a little worried about this. It turns out because of all these delays, they're missing the Colombo BEPI launch to Mercury by about 2 years now. Back to you, Dick.
Does that mean Colombo BEPI is going to launch in another window than the one that was intended?
No, they stuck to their guns. They're going up this October. But, they were, discussions were going back and forth. Maybe, we could push James Webb a little earlier or a little later, but it turns out now that's 2 years away. So, no, they stuck to their window.
Yeah, it turns out that it takes a lot of energy to boost something into a higher orbit. It takes a lot of dissipation of energy to boost something into an orbit closer to the sun. So you have to do a lot of flybys of these other Venus and Mercury and Earth to literally dissipate energy. Otherwise, you'd end up going toward Mercury and arriving at too high a velocity, and they don't have enough thrust capability to slow it down to put it in orbit around Mercury. So this thing's going to go in orbit around Mercury, I presume. And is that going to be a highly elliptical orbit? Do you remember, Paul Grad?
I just remember they wanted to do a polar orbit. Yeah, but yeah, Mariner 10 was, you know, the first one to take pictures of Mercury. When was that? I'm going to guess either the late 60s or early 70s. But Mariner 10 did that. They just flew by, and that was all they expected. It wasn't until Messenger, the one that we sent, that actually went into orbit around Mercury. Now the European Space Agency is doing the same thing. So, as far as the orbit goes, it's actually going to be two satellites when it gets there. There's going to be one in tight, one a little further away. It's Colombo-Beppe mission. And it's really a combination between European Space Agency and Japan. Japan's got one satellite, and European Space Agency has the other. So, and they're both going into orbit.
Now, what requires two satellites in orbit at the same time? Is one acting as a relay for the other, Paul? Go ahead.
One is doing very close observation of Mercury, and the other one's going to be out there further away. Doing its thing further away. I didn't look that close to the science behind it, so I don't know.
I think Mercury has one face always aimed toward the sun. So it's got a hot side and a cold side. I wonder what the weather is like on the cold side. Any indication on that one, Paul?
No, I don't think Mercury's not locked. It's not locked. It's not like Jupiter and Charon. Pluto and Charon. They're staring at each other the whole time. Mercury turns, and I think it's 3-to-1 ratio with the orbit of 88 days. So it actually turns, but it's really slow. So, if you're on Mercury near the Terminator, you'd be able to actually outrun it or keep up with it, if you were a good runner. That's how fast the Terminator moves.
I think Mercury has essentially no atmosphere, is that true? Like it's all been boiled away?
Yeah, as far as I know, there might be molecules or something. Very rarefied, but as far as I've seen pictures of, I don't know, it looks like the moon to me. But I think they just want to research it just to get answers on how these things got to where they are and how they were created. And I guess it gives the scientists more insight into Earth itself, Venus. Why one becomes one way, one becomes the other. Mercury's in closer to the sun, but yet it's not as hot as Venus. And that's due to the greenhouse effect. So I guess they want to study all this stuff. I'm assuming. I don't know. I'm more interested in getting there and getting into all of it.
There's a satellite that's investigating the corona of the sun. And with its fancy heat shield, it's an orbit inside of Mercury's orbit. What's the status of that one, Paul Grant?
Yeah, that one's good to go. That's Parker. Is it July or August? I can check real quick. But it's coming up, a couple of months. And talk about trying to slow things down to get into these, in this case, solar orbit, but very, very tight in. Again, it has to go through quite a few Parker satellites. It's going to have to go through quite a few gravity systems to slow it down. And that's going to be launched on the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV is a big rocket, man. I don't know. It's like the size of a Falcon 9, except it's got one big engine called RS-68, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. So take three of these things, bolt them together. So that's why they call it the Delta IV Heavy. And it's the biggest rocket NASA uses. And they're only putting this relatively small, I forget, 1,000-pound satellite on top called Parker. And why are they using this thing? But the goal is, you know, because once the idea is to slow this thing down relative to Earth. We're going around at 66,000 miles an hour. You've got to go a lot slower than that to get into a tight solar orbit. Back to you there.
Is Parker going to do a number of flybys of Mercury and Venus in order to do the slowdown?
I don't remember Mercury on that list. But yeah, Venus. I think half a dozen Venus, I might be wrong, but I think six passes of Venus slow it down. And we don't need any data from Venus anyway. We have plenty from the Magellan mission that went up many years ago in the '80s. And that was a radar, SAR mission, synthetic aperture radar mission. And that's why we know exactly what Venus looked like. We don't need any research from that, but we do need to use Venus to help slow this thing down to get, I think it's 3.8 million miles from the, I'm going to call it the surface of the sun.
Sounds like the Parker is going to almost be bathed in the outer corona atmosphere, so to speak. In other words, it sounds like it's going to be so close it'll be hitting some of the particles. And I think part of what Parker's going to do is try to explain why the corona around Venus is hotter than the photosphere, than the surface that you see that's in closer. So I think that's part of Parker's mission, is to try to explain what's the mechanism by which the corona becomes that hot. So did they mention that Parker is going to be touching the molecules of the upper corona?
I'm not sure. I would imagine it's going to be, when they say from the surface of the sun, I mean, it's probably from the corona, I would imagine. But yeah, 3.5 million miles. I don't know what the benchmark is, but from where. So, give you an idea, Mercury is 88 million miles from the, no, let's see, no, we're 93. I used to have the Mercury memorized. But it's way inside of Mercury's orbit. And I want to find out if Carl Sagan is right. He said either sound or the blast of the corona mass ejection is hitting the corona at such a speed as it's leaving the sun. He used to think that that's why the corona got heated to 1 million degrees. We got to find out if Carl Sagan was right. Maybe Parker will tell me.
I wonder if Parker is going to be rugged enough that if a coronal mass ejection from the sun occurred in the direction toward Parker, is it rugged enough to be able to survive all of that matter hitting it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Temperature-wise, it will. But I don't know about actually, getting hit with protons and electrons, whatever's coming off the sun. But it's going to be covered with, the front end of it is going to have a protection shield of 4-inch thick carbon-carbon. Carbon-carbon was, if you look at the nose of the space shuttle, that's what that was made of. coughing, coughing. And that protected the nose as it re-entered the atmosphere. They never had a problem with that, although they had problems with the wings. But, you know, that's because it was destroyed from the insulation off the the tank. So, you know, this material's been used before, and you know, 4 inches thick. That sounds big to me. It's also going to have a real cooling system for the solar panels. It's going to actually have an active cooling system, rotating liquid throughout the solar panels when it's near the sun. And then eventually it's going to go further west of the sun. It's going to be somewhat elliptical, and it'll keep making these passes. And it's quite a few years from now by the time this thing ever gets into a tight orbit around the sun. It's going to go off in, what, say, August. It's going to be quite a few years before we really get any kind of, you know, results on how this thing is doing.
Being that close to the sun to get electrical power, my guess is the solar panels don't have to be very big, but they've got to be cool because the sun-facing side is going to be running too hot. That's amazing. And now, the cooling system, where in the world does it dump its heat? Into the shadow behind Parker, I guess. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I saw what the thing looked like. It did look like it had radiation coming out of the back of it. And I read about the cooling system. I haven't seen it yet, but they're supposed to have these very fine tubes running in, you know, in throughout the solar panel. And they're not going to be on all the time. It's only going to be when they're near the sun, then they go further away, then they'll shut the cooling system down and you know, just use regular, you know, it'll just pick up the sun's rays, you know, normally. But this should be interesting to see if all this stuff works. And just to get off the launch pad, I believe it's supposed to launch from, Florida. I'll make a point of watching that thing take over. And when you see a Delta IV launch, it's pretty cool. It's very impressive. Some people will say not as impressive as the Falcon Heavy when that went up, because you know that had the boosters come back, land on land, and had the other one that was supposed to land on the autonomous ship. But still, the Delta IV when that goes up, it's pretty cool. It's got this yellowish look on the flame coming out. You wouldn't think so because it's liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. You think it would look like the shuttle when they drop it. You know, from the shuttle main engines, but it's got this blade of material that comes off the cone of the bell of the rocket and that's what actually keeps it cool, because these RS-68 engines don't have to be cooled. They don't have to be, they have to be cooled, but they don't have to be reused, is what I meant to say. Back to you there.
I think you said earlier that Chandra, I think Chandra is ultraviolet or X-ray. I think it's X-ray. I believe it's still in operation since 1990, I think you said. And they're thinking of building an upgrade to it. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's called the Lynx, O-Y-N-X. I'm not sure what that stands for. Maybe it doesn't stand for anything. But yeah, that's the plan. If you look at the mirrors in Chandra, it's got these long tubes, inch and a quarter diameter tubes that are bundled together. You know, you take a bunch of pipes and bundle them together and tie a rope around it. That's what it looks like. And you point it at something. You know, you point the open ends at a star somewhere. And these X-rays come down and they hit these glass tubes. And that's what it slows it down. It can't use a regular mirror because the X-rays go right through it. So it kind of like hits it at an angle, it's a long angle, and especially gets down to the detector, and that's how Chandra works, and I assume Lynx is going to work the same way.
I think those x-rays were degrading the detectors, as I remember. I think those detectors have lost some of their sensitivity, isn't that true?
Don't know, I haven't read that. I know it's still functioning. I mean, sometimes you'll read a report that, you know, new discovery or this is taken by Chandra.
Yeah, I believe the actual x-rays strike the mirror at an extremely shallow angle, almost parallel to the mirror, so to speak. And you do get a reflection that way. And so it's a real crazy mirror, but it does do focusing. I think we're going to end a little early tonight. So I thank you, Paul. Thank you, Roy. 73, you all. That was TechNet number what? 1703. And that was Space Report number 303. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. See you guys next week. K2IW clear but listening.
WB to GXM.
Who are you calling, GXM?
Dick, if anyone on the net is still there, I just reminding everybody that the friendly candy company is ending net neutrality tomorrow. Watch your bills carefully, WB2GXM.
Give us a couple of words on that. The ending of net neutrality really means what to who and why do things become more expensive.
It means hang on to your wallet, Dick. I'll be listening to this. WS2N. 73, guys.
I don't know exactly what it means right now, but basically what it means is that your net providers have become deregulated. They can do whatever they want, WB2GXM.
AC2GX.
Go right ahead, Roy.
Unfortunately, deregulation might have the effect of internet service providers providing better service for other services their own or that pay them off. So there might be a time when YouTube ran slower or Amazon Prime ran slower, and they'll just kind of cluck their teeth and say, well, then pay us for the higher tier. That's a sort of worst-case scenario. Hopefully the states will get involved and lock it down in enough court cases so that eventually when the FCC changes hands, they'll change it back again. I have a duplex that's set up that's recording from the repeater, and when I take the time to listen to myself, I hear it as well. I can't tell you why it's doing it, again, because I did the exact same thing with KC2RC, and I do a TechNet there, and there's no click. So there's something curious about an interaction between my radio system and Limox's repeater.
Yeah, interesting, but I don't know what it is yet, but, because I didn't really, you know, look at it that closely either.
Okay, I mean, I've heard all kinds of interesting possibilities, that the PL tone is slightly off, or that I'm transmitting off frequency. I don't think so, but I don't have any immediate way of checking either of those possibilities.
You don't sound off at all. You sound fine. But I got to listen on the input, which I didn't do yet.
Okay. Anytime you want, I can make myself available. I think that Dick mentioned that he heard me on the input and he didn't hear anything, so I don't have a clue.
I hear you on the input fine. But right now, see, it's not doing it, so I'm not sure.
Murphy's Law strikes again.
Yeah, it's like a patient going to the doctor and all of a sudden the patient is cured.
Well, if I'm cured, I'm a happy person. The problem is that the symptoms fade away for a while, then come right back.
Yeah. All right. Have you been otherwise? Everything good?
I've been fine. Got myself a pair of reading glasses. Joined the rest of you guys who need glasses to read. I guess I'm using up my eyeballs. So I have a couple of stacks of books to hit, and hopefully they won't hit me back.
Oh, you were talking about that earlier. Yeah. All right. Well, interesting conversations for sure.
Yeah, the funny thing is you can't kind of predict what will kind of catch people's interest and what they'll just kind of listen to and move on to the next subject. Like I mentioned earlier tonight, I once came on with basically two sentences, and somehow we took up an hour and a half with those two sentences. I think I burnt about 5 or 6 pages worth of stuff tonight.
Yeah, I was listening partly from the car. And then I was listening from the handheld downstairs while watching the Tony Awards tonight. Because I was interested in both. Although I could have recorded the Tonys and played it back, but I never do. Because it's easy to record. So, but I was doing both. So I was going back and forth.
Okay, whatever works for you. They call it multitasking. I tend to find that when I multitask, I tend to favor one of the tasks versus the other.
Yeah, that's true. So I saw oh boy. from your repeater. From the KCRA Club. He was at the Weimark Ham Fair today. And why does his name all of a sudden escape me? You know, it's on the tip of my tongue. And it's funny, when he came up to me, he said, "You know who I am?" And then I didn't realize it at first, and I said, "Oh yeah, you're such and such." I can't think of the name. Why is it I have a blank? Anyway, you know who I'm talking about. Mitch. See, I knew it would come back. I saw Mitch today. It's funny. Yeah, he came up and said hello.
Yeah, I heard he was going to go there. Mitch. Well, you know, Mitch is not a popular ham name. I mean, about every third person is named Richard or Dick. And one-third are named Joe, and about one-fifth apparently are named Andy. I actually bumped into a fellow Roy from down south on 10 meters a week or two ago, and I was amazed at the opportunity to talk to someone with the same first name. But there aren't that many Mitches in my mind. I can't really think of another ham that's named Mitch.
Yeah, that's why the name escapes me so much. And I guess the repeater's going to shut off in about 4 minutes. It's 12 o'clock or so. So we'll have to move to some other frequency. But, now I'm trying to remember his call. Because that escaped me also. think it starts with an A. But it'll come back. Not that it's really important. But, and then I asked him about the repeater. And he told me he's waiting for something to come in. I'm not sure what. I don't remember exactly what he mentioned. But, anyway. Yep, so I did see him.
Net.
Yeah, his call sign is N2RGA. And my understanding is we've been having problems interfacing the controller into the Fusion Technology DR2X repeater. And at this point, we're starting to think that when we sent the repeater back to Yaesu to have them fix the connectors for access to a controller, they crossed wires somewhere. So the last I was talking to Mitch, he had to test a couple of voltage across some pins to find out if they were wired correctly or incorrectly. And if incorrectly, I guess we'll have to ship it back to Yaesu to have them modify it in the correct manner.
Okay. It seems like it's such a simple thing. It's become so complicated. Back and forth, it's... I don't quite understand it just yet.
Yeah, this has not been an efficient operation, but what can you do?
That's all right. Look, as long as things keep on working to a degree, it's all right.
I mean, the only thing we're really missing is a courtesy beep and a squelch. But otherwise, you know, I mean, whether it does announces or doesn't do announces isn't going to impact people terribly much.
Nope, that's for sure. All right. There's always ways to communicate. And that's what it's all about anyway. Isn't the bottom line communication? That's what life's all about anyway. It's all about communicating to other people and other forms of life.
Well, but that's the premise. But surprisingly, I've found more than a few amateur radio operators who weren't particularly good communicators, which is confusing as hell.
Yeah, well, some people talk in littles. And you have to sort of, like, make sense of what they're trying to convey.
I guess so, and other people are crystal gazers. You know, we come in all shapes and sizes. To one degree or another, that's kind of interesting. You don't want to hear everyone sounding alike.
Break. Who is this?
KC2ZOR.
All right, you're gonna come in about a minute because the repeater's gonna go off, and your audio is extremely low. Did you hear what I said?
In any second. So, 73. Have a good week. I'll talk to you soon.
I'll call you on the phone. Not tonight. Maybe tomorrow, next day, whatever. All right. See ya.
How's this? KC2ZOR.
Well, the repeat is off now, but I hear myself, and ZOR, I got you.
Right, I'm just checking my antenna. My son came over today and helped me put back the antennas that got knocked down by the storm. And I was just trying to make sure that they're operating. So how's the signal? And I'm over here in Selden.
You're fine. Getting into the repeater fine, I have no problem hearing you. I'm hearing myself too.
Okay, thank you very much. I won't take any more of your time. And I appreciate the comeback. And the check that the signal's working. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, the antenna's working. It's doing its job, getting into reaching it nicely. Okay, 73, take care, WHC.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
November Victor Zulu, listening.
Yeah.